Housekeeper, what does that conjure up for you? A grim-faced Mrs. Danvers, or Mrs. Hughes, a housekeeper with a heart in Downton? Who is your housekeeper? It's probably you, as you have now succumbed to the role of paying bills, doing the dry cleaning, getting the plumber, working out a budget. Or maybe you do have a housekeeper. She'll probably not be English and will do everything. Unlike housekeepers in the large country houses who had a specific role. And that's what we're talking about today with ex-Telegraph editor and feature writer Tessa Bowes, who has written The Housekeeper's Tale, The Women Who Really Ran the English Country House. Hi, Tessa.
Hi.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Lovely to be here.
So what was the actual role of a housekeeper in the height of the 19th century?
She was a little like the manager of a large hotel. I mean, we tend to think of the butler as being the boss. That wasn't the case. They often had equal pay, but I would say the housekeeper looked after way more departments. She looked after all the women in the house, all the maids. There were many, many maids in the Victorian house because the Victorian house was full of knick-knacks, spoils of empire, sort of plump cushions and aspidistras. And if you imagine a really big country house, there would have been so much to take care of. She had a massive team, dozens, sometimes hundreds in the really big houses to oversee. The butler was just looking after the footman, the cellar, and often was living in a little sort of self-contained flat. But the housekeeper was very much at the centre of things below stairs. But really, up until now, has not had a kind of voice or identity or prestige. No one's written a book about her. But as I began to research my book, I soon realised why, because there was so little material out there. If you think about who you might employ as a housekeeper, you would want somebody, first of all, to be incredibly discreet. She is looking after your household secrets. And for the aristocracy, this was obviously a big deal. All that Edwardian bed hopping, the kind of mad stepson. She knew everything. And you had to have someone who was the absolute soul of discretion. This sort of woman would not leave behind her racy kiss and tell diaries or write indiscreet letters. She was probably a sort of dull, dry old stick. This would be your fantasy housekeeper. Probably widowed or single, no ties. But the reality, of course, was somewhat different. It was very hard to get this paragon of virtue.
As we know, you just can't get the staff nowadays.
That's right. Very, very, very hard. So when I began digging, I was worried about this whole subject of the housekeeper because they did seem to be quite dull, you know, buried in the family graveyard after 50 years, loyal service. I thought, how am I going to make this sexy? Because I wanted to know what their feelings were, what the difficulties of the job were, emotionally, physically, what they'd given up. Who were they? And the ones that seemed more interesting to me were the ones for whom it went wrong. And these were not necessarily your stereotype. There was one very beautiful one who worked at Erddig Hall, or if you're Welsh, Erddig, in the Welsh borders. Very beautiful. I was absolutely intrigued by this photograph of her. She is an Edwardian kind of Gibson girl with her sort of long, sporty jaw and Pompadour hairstyle. She fell horribly foul of the regime after 7 years loyal service. Was discovered to have stolen, it appeared, £500.
How much was that then?
That then was about £30,000.
Wow.
A great deal of money. Her mistress was a poor curate's daughter, spectacularly rescued from spinsterhood, age 39, which then, even then, was kind of absolutely on the shelf. So she was elated to have married into the rather impecunious Erddig, the York family. And she was very bad at choosing servants and at running the house and at managing the servants and had left rather too much for this housekeeper, the beautiful Ellen Penketh, to do. Ellen was 32. She'd come from a very poor working class background in Manchester, never been a housekeeper before. She'd been a sort of assistant kitchen maid. But there she was, And she was expected not only to cook for these great big house parties they kept having, but to run the household accounts, the finances. And I went through the accounts books in the archive office, and there it all is. Every purchase entered, totted up, ticked off.
What sort of purchases?
Well, my goodness me, anything from a portrait of the baby to arrowroot to coal to getting a clock mended, a chair restuffed. I mean, all your food supplies, all the repairs to the household, but and quite personal things too. You know, having your mistress's jewellery attended to, or your master's kind of dentures paid for, that sort of thing. So she knew everything. She also knew that her mistress was very anxious about money. And month after month, in Louisa York's handwriting, it says at the bottom of this accounts book, overspent. And I just tried to imagine how that must have felt for Mrs. Penketh to have this book given back to her, like a teacher's comment, overspent, and how awful that must have made her feel and how anxious. And she did something very silly. She started suppressing the accounts with the collusion of the butcher, the baker, the grocer. She asked them to enter a kind of false amount and say, I'll make it up to you next month because Mrs. York will go mad if I've overspent again. It wasn't her fault because the Yorks kept entertaining on a limited budget. So she sort of did what she could, but got in a horrible muddle and couldn't pay it back and was then discovered. And the story then gets very dramatic. She was sent to prison because the Yorks decided to press charges. And I was able to read about this all in the local newspapers, which made a huge deal of it. It was a very juicy story, the charge against a Wrexham housekeeper. And the entire finances of Erddig were combed through in the press, which was hideous for the York family. It went to trial. I wonder if I should tell you what happened, because obviously I want people to read the book, but it has a very surprising outcome, and it's perhaps indicative of the time. This is 1907. When perhaps the aristocracy were not necessarily so popular anymore, and their word didn't always count, and there was increasing kind of unrest between the working classes and the upper classes. So I thought when I found that story, it was really a sort of story of its time. I then tried to find out what happened to poor Ellen Penketh, and I managed to find her in the census, so I then sent off for her death certificate, which was always quite a poignant moment in my research to find out what happened to these women who'd worked so hard and had really given their youth and their lives to these families. She was unmarried, no children. She'd had to go back to living with her mother in a room over a shop with a whole load of other family members. She found work as a cook in a Manchester hotel. She would never work as a servant again because of her notoriety, even though in the end she was found not to be to blame. She died of a massive stroke, age 61, which is, you know, it's young really, but she had
not for then.
She'd had a really tough life in a state hospital of 1,000 beds on the site of the old Salford workhouse. So that was a kind of a poignant end, really. Yeah. And I felt, as with all the stories in my book, pleased to have reinstated her and to have given her back her voice and told her side of the story. Because Erddig makes a big deal today, it's a National Trust house, about the servants and how well the York family treated the servants. And there are portraits of them all over the walls and nothing to be seen of Ellen Penketh. She just does not figure. She is a ghost in their archives, so I was pleased to put her back in the story.
So it really was. Sounds like it was a fight, really, between the kind of the lady of the house and the kind of housekeeper. It's, she didn't like her, did she?
I think she was perhaps jealous of her. They were similar in age. Louisa York was not a beauty. She was quite sort of dumpy and frowsy and prim. And I don't know, Ellen was rather gorgeous Lancastrian girl.
Yeah, you can imagine, kind of hearty and strong. Yeah.
Yes, and they shared intimacies initially, yeah, but it went sour.
And you know, kind of northerners, they say what they think. They're kind of very warm, aren't they? So you can imagine, and then there's this other, her ladyship is sort of uptight.
Yes, I mean, as with today, it often boils down to its personalities. And I think the below stairs, a house could be a happy house or it could be an unhappy house. But often it was to do with, you know, the boss, the housekeeper, and she affected the atmosphere below stairs. And I found kind of acrimonious letters written, for example, by one butler saying, "This house could be the happiest place if it wasn't for one woman, Miss Harrison, often to be found the worse for beer," sort of thing.
Don't blame her.
I know. No, many of them did turn to drink, I think.
Oh, I bet,
One of my housekeepers who ran a particularly quarrelsome lot of maids below stairs was Mrs. Wells, who is the mother of H.G. Wells. And she was a high Victorian housekeeper at Uphark in West Sussex. She had previously run her own house, but her husband was never very good at earning money and they were desperately hard up.
So were they middle class?
Very precariously middle class. Mm-hmm. They had a crockery shop in Bromley. Mm-hmm. And she had once worked as a lady's maid at Uphark in her youth, in her early 20s, just for a couple of years, and had met her husband, Joe, who was a gardener there. She'd met him there. No sooner had she met him than she had to leave because you couldn't stay in service if you were married. She was then invited back a good 20 years later by her old mistress. And she had no experience whatsoever of running a big house at all. She'd sort of known how to, you know, do hair and mend dresses. And she was a diary keeper. And because she's the mother of H.G. Wells, her diaries have been kept. And I read them all, my goodness, pages, hundreds of pages in this quavering copperplate script. Quite dull, but once you read them all, you get this very poignant picture of life below stairs for a woman in her 60s, not in the best of health, going deaf, bad teeth, rheumatism, trying to control these maids. And you see them come and go, and she's always writing off for more. And she gets, in the period of, I think she's there 11 years, 10 cooks come and go in 11 years.
What?
Which must have been hideous for her.
It must be her though, mustn't it? I'm not being mean, but...
I think it was a combination of her and the fact that Uphart was a curious country house. It was not a very sort of whizzy, sociable, glamorous country house. It was stuck in Aspic. These were the high Victorian times, but Uphart was in a total time warp. No central heating, no plumbing. The lady of the house, Frances Featherstonehoff, had been left it by her sister, who was once a dairymaid, and the dairymaid had married Sir Harry Featherstonehoff. He'd fallen in love with his dairymaid. So this was a very unusual story.
So romantic.
Kind of romantic, but and yet socially awkward. It had sort of put things out of kilter in this house. And I think poor old Mrs. Wells inherited this. Nothing was quite right. No one really wanted to work there. It wasn't like working for the aristocracy. It was a bit sort of below par, frankly.
Yes, a bit embarrassing, darling.
Yes, and the Featherstonehoff, Lady Frances Featherstonehoff, was kind of laughed about amongst the gentry. Anyway, Mrs. Wells started to go a bit mad. And H.G. Wells wrote about this in his autobiography, and he joked about it, really. He said she was the worst housekeeper ever thought of, and he lists all the things she was bad at. So I went back to her diaries and whatever remaining archives there are at Uphark to work out if she really was crap or whether she was working in impossible circumstances. And very touchingly, she often wrote in her diary about getting out. She's always longing to get out. The servants' quarters at Uphark are absolutely below ground. They are basement. They are dank, they are dark, and there are long tunnels that you have to walk along to get from her room to the kitchen or to the dairy. It's a sort of troglodyte existence. And she writes of, she gets out to see the primroses. You know, this is maybe once in 2 months she gets out. She hardly ever sees the air, the blue sky. And I think she gets very depressed. And I was thinking about what we call SAD today, seasonally affective disorder, when you're deprived of sunlight, and how that can induce depression. And I wondered what the Victorians knew about the connection between environment and mental health. And they didn't know very much. They were just beginning to make connections, but women would be described as hysterical. Mm. And she starts writing in her diary things like, strange such things one sees and hears. What a worry this house is. When will I feel settled?
Oh, no.
She's unhappy and paranoid. And then she gets sacked out of the blue.
Oh.
She's 70 and very deaf by now. And her mistress, who's about 78, just gets fed up with her.
Mm.
And she's out on a limb with nothing.
God.
Fortunately, her son is just beginning to earn his way as a writer, and he scoops her up and saves her. So this story has a happy ending. For most women in her situation, it would have been the workhouse.
And can you tell us about the workhouse? Because we've got visions of it from Oliver, but what happened in them?
Well, those visions from Oliver are probably pretty correct. You were segregated. So Mrs. Wells, who was married, could not have been with her husband. Husbands and wives were split up. It was to make it a very unpopular, absolute last resort. So it wasn't like, you know, going on benefits. It was the worst. Children were separated from parents and you were put to work. Sewing. Young boys had to kind of do things like rope making. I mean, work that was really hard for your hands. You all had to wear a uniform. And there are photos of all these old dears lined up, all looking exactly the same with their kind of sewing work in their laps, eating pretty much like Oliver, gruel. Mm. I found contemporary newspaper reports of people in workhouses going on strike because they didn't like their mutton broth or whatever it was that they had to have every Wednesday. I also found a disproportionate number of upper servants ending up in workhouses, and by that I mean the housekeeper, the cook, the lady's maid, those who had prestige, airs and graces, a kind of reasonable salary for servants, were then reduced to the kind of lowest of the low.
Now, I wonder, do you think they couldn't save because their wages were so low?
It probably depended on their family circumstances. They might well have had to be sending money back to their family. Some did amass quite a lot of money, and because they never had to spend, but it might have been those who had a really long tenure with one house and just didn't need any other family. The house kind of became their family. They were totally assimilated. They had no other ties. But in the case of Mrs. Wells, she was supporting her husband, three sons. She had nothing. She hadn't saved a penny. And utter anxiety is there writ large in her diaries. She keeps going to this, I mean, poor woman, she's 70 and deaf. She goes to this employment agency and writes off to everyone she can think of, but no one's going to employ a deaf 70-year-old, even if they were once housekeeper of Upart. They're just not. And yeah, it was
so
very
people
harsh.
Had to work till they dropped.
They did. Many housekeepers died on the job.
Mm.
If the family was kind, they were pensioned off in an estate cottage, or sort of given very light duties, but sort of kept involved.
Yeah, like you say, a little bit of sewing.
Yes. Yeah. Those are probably the ones the aristocracy will tell us about, because it shows them in a very good light. And those are the ones that will get a tomb in the family graveyard. And people will reflect fondly and say, oh, she was almost family, but that almost is a big almost, really.
Yeah, tell me about the divide then socially. Who, the housekeeper, because they're not a servant in that way, they're not a maid, and they're not, you know, aristocrats. Who were their friends? Who were their confidants?
Well, this is an interesting question. I tried hard to get my head into their world and to think, well, Who would they have confided in? It would have been very dangerous to have become best mates with the lady's maid, or even with anyone less senior. I think Downton Abbey casts a very sort of cosy, rosy picture of everyone sort of nattering away fondly around Mrs. Hughes. I think you had to be very careful about gossip. And you probably carried a lot close to your chest, and that probably took its toll emotionally. H.G. Wells does write some quite funny memories, because he visited Upark a lot. He was a teenager when his mum was there. He fictionalised it in a book, Tono Bungay, and he writes these hilarious scenes where her mother gets visited by previous upper servants or upper servants from neighbouring big houses. And he says, and they sit around dressed in a sort of black with a lot of sort of jet, aping the manners and accents of their superior in this rather pathetic charade at sort of niceties and making kind of desperately dull conversation, such as the days they do draw out. And
I remember ladies like grannies like that, though, in kind of tea rooms. Do you remember them when you were young? Sort of people from like the First World War, sort of, hello, dear, you know, sort of people.
Yes, and it's funny that sort of assimilation with the family. I looked at the housekeeper of Charleston, the Bloomsbury farmhouse in Sussex, Grace Higgins, who was there for 50 years from the 1920s, and she retired in 1971, earning £5 a week. She didn't get a pay rise for many years. But there's one interview with her, because the Bloomsbury Group obviously got a lot of sort of media attention. As time went on, someone came and interviewed her in the kitchen for her memories of Virginia Woolf. Grace was a Norfolk girl, and by all accounts she had a Norfolk accent, but not while she was being interviewed. She sort of starts to talk like this. She's asked how often she had her portrait painted, which was often. She says, I don't have much time to sit for the artists.
Because she was a beauty, wasn't she? I've seen pictures in your book.
Grace was another beauty, yeah. Actually. And yeah. Again, completely not what you imagine the housekeeper to look like. So beautiful that Clive Bell, the old lech, was always kind of coming round and making inappropriate comments, as we would say today. He once gave her an Easter present of a pair of silk stockings concealed inside an egg.
Wow, that is really sexy.
That's quite racy. Yeah. She says in her diary, she was another diary keeper, she says, I must not let Mary Alice know. That was another maid.
Now, I wonder if she had affairs with any of the men. I bet she did when she was, you know.
Well, that's what one might imagine of Bloomsbury, but she's quite prim. She's in great demand, and she finds it much easier to stay in reading her books than going out, because she gets so much attention she can't cope with it, because she is very handsome. Really annoyingly, there's a big gap in her diaries, the archive, which is now at the British Library, the Grace Higgins papers, which covers those years that she would have been having boyfriends and affairs or whatever. Her son thought that she destroyed them because the material was too personal.
Ah, who knows? That's a good sign. Yeah.
But apparently she had two proposals in France. They used to all go en masse to France for 3 months every winter. She was proposed to by the owner of a patisserie.
Oh.
And apparently an Eastern European count.
Wow.
And each man asked the permission of Mrs. Vanessa Bell, being the nearest thing she had to kind of a parent in France anyway. And Grace turned them both down. And I think it was complicated with Grace. It is a real story of loyalty. I mean, 50 years she gave her life to this family. She was 16 when she joined them. And they kind of became her family. I mean, she came from a very kind of solid, loving family in Banham in Norfolk. But this very unconventional kind of Bloomsbury family became more family to Grace than her own tribe in the end. She probably thought that if she married, she would lose her job, which kind of was the norm. So when she finally did meet a man, Walter Higgins, she was 30, which again was, you know, kind of on the shelf back in the 1930s. And she probably thought, oh, this is my last chance. What am I going to do? And asked Mrs. Bell if she and Walter could possibly live together in the attics of Charleston. What did Vanessa make of this? When Vanessa's letters were published in the early 90s, Grace's son discovered that his father was referred to by Vanessa as the dolt. She was really cruel about Grace's choice of man. She thought that Grace, who had a brain, was handsome and intelligent, if uneducated, and she was a voracious reader, they thought she could have done much, much better. Walter came from kind of solid agricultural stock. Mm. He was unexceptional, kind man, apparently a funny man and a loving man. Grace never complained about him in her diaries, ever. But Vanessa took against him from the start. So she kind of gritted her teeth, because in the 30s it was not very easy to get live-in help. It was not a profession.
No, it was the time when there weren't many around.
Yeah, after the First World War, it was very hard to entice young women back.
So was he allowed to live in the attic?
He was allowed.
Did they marry?
They married. Mm. And he slightly kind of... He reluctantly became Vanessa's gardener. And she writes awful things in her letters about him. How she drives the dolt with an iron rod. I know no mercy. And how big his cabbage patch is as a result. They had a strange life there, because Vanessa and Duncan Grant, who was her sort of partner, but he was gay, they, for most of the time, were in London. They used Charleston at weekends and for holidays. So the Higgins family, Grace had a little boy, John, again, unusual for a servant.
Yeah.
They lived in the attics, and for most of the time, they had free run of the house and the garden.
Wow.
And then the family would turn up, and they would have to make themselves very scarce. Yeah. So it was a strange, slightly schizophrenic existence.
But then weren't a lot of country houses like that, because they were just used, you know, as like lodgers, or people owned like five houses and they, you know, the season they'd change where they go and, you know.
Yes.
I mean, maybe servants did have more of a run and they could have sat around enjoying themselves, you know, and then...
I mean, they did.
Yeah.
And then they had to whisk the dust sheets off and kind of make it look kind of sparkling and ready at a moment's notice. Yeah, I think for many servants in those situations, it was actually very lonely, because they didn't have families. And you can imagine trying to sort of keep kind of young, bored maids and footmen apart from each other, which would have been the housekeeper's job. That was difficult. But Grace had her family, so I think she did achieve a kind of life apart in the end.
She was a lucky woman in service, wasn't she?
She was. Mm. She felt she couldn't leave, though, because she had this kind of extraordinary long association with the family. And like Mrs. Wells, she got into her 60s, beyond the age of retirement, and kept writing in her diary, "How I long to leave. I am so tired. I want to stop work. Work, 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 never a rest." By this stage, her mistress, Vanessa Bell, was dead, and she was left with Duncan Grant, who was increasingly kind of incontinent, both socially and physically, actually. He couldn't stop having house parties, but also his bodily needs were, you know, Grace was a full-on carer as well as housekeeper. And in the end, in 1971, she had enough. And by coincidence, that's when the first episode of Upstairs, Downstairs aired. So ironically, here was this live-in servant, still alive, still serving. She just...
Where did they go and live?
They bought themselves what was called a chalet in a nearby village. And she never looked back. She loved her retirement. She couldn't get over having nothing to do, having a fitted kitchen, having central heating and a carpet, and being her own boss. She loved every minute of it, but felt forever guilty about leaving Duncan Grant. And until his death, she worried about him and visited him.
So I'm interested to know, how long did she live after that?
She died in 1984, so of cancer. So she had 13 years of retirement at least. Yeah. She had a good run, but I suppose it could have been longer. But she had been in service from the age of 16, and that's an extraordinary thought, that she hadn't known freedom ever at all. Her own front door she never had.
You said freedom. I mean, were they slaves?
Yeah, it depends how you look on it. Grace's son John thought she was a slave. From his perspective, a different generation, especially when his girlfriend and then wife Diana came on the scene and looked with fresh eyes at this funny world, he thought they treated her, and he was interviewed about it. He was very frank. He said it was slave labour.
Housekeeper's Tale is by Tessa Bowes and is published by Oram Press. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and giving us a glimpse into these women's lives.
Thank you, Josephine.